Chapter 19. Ronnie Richardson and Tessa Murray travelled from Paris to London by Eurostar, under impeccable French passports. They spoke French to each other, and appeared to understand only minimal English. Early in their relationship, Ronnie had made Tessa learn French by giving her a linguaphone course. He then brought her to Paris and sat her down for 5 weeks, surrounded by native Parisians, so that she could learn the accent. Now, years later, people born and bred in the City of Lights would have great difficulty distinguishing Claude and Thérèse Fernet from the real thing. Alone, they referred to themselves as the Fernet Brancas, after the unpalatable French drink, alleged to be an infallible hangover cure. They were skillfully disguised, though not with false beards and hair pieces. Tessa's hair was heavily greyed, pulled back from her face and tied severely in a bun. This device added a good 10 years to her age. She wore a ludicrously short leather skirt and impossibly high heels, heavy eyeshadow and thick blusher, giving herself an almost bizarre appearance. She was also slightly plump around the midriff, wearing a padded undergarment Ronnie had made for her 3 years before. The transformation was wonderful. Old friends could walk past her without a sign of recognition. On one occasion, when trying out the disguise in London during the previous year, an acquaintance had recognized her, then, on coming closer, was covered with embarrassment, apologizing and saying that she looked just like an old school friend, but now I can see you're much older. Then the woman had realized she'd made a dreadful gaffe and went away even more confused. Ronnie Richardson used a special comb to thin his hair, which he also touched up with grey. He did not wear spectacles, but had inserted coloured contact lenses, which made his eyes a startling light grey. Ronnie was a great believer in altering your appearance by drawing attention to a new person. To the change in hair and eye colour, he added a third feature, becoming a cripple, complete with wheelchair and frayed temper. Years before, he had been confined to a wheelchair for some weeks after breaking both feet. He'd fallen from a third-story window and landed square on his heels. Did he fall or was he pushed? Like all men who have been wheelchair-bound, he soon found that unless you assert yourself, you are treated like someone who is mentally handicapped. So they changed from being a 40-something couple to a pair set firmly in late middle age, cantankerous and unattractive, with few redeeming features. Within an hour of their arrival at Waterloo train station, they were swallowed up, becoming two entirely different people. They switched cabs 3 times before dropping off at Ronnie's flat halfway up New Cavendish Street, where they transformed themselves into what Richardson described as a pair of sad old sheep, Martin and Molly Meadows, whom you could hardly detect with a fine pair of binoculars, and certainly not with your eyes. Their documents were American, as were their voices, New York nasal, and proud of it. By tea time, they'd booked into the Ritz, where they became immediately invisible, grey people in forgettable clothes, people who had difficulty in catching a waiter's eye, which is quite a trick at the Ritz, where they provide an ever-ready service. "Only for a couple of days," Ronnie promised. For to tell the truth, Molly Meadows was not Tess's favourite character. "Get the lie of the land, decide on the plan, then we'll move on." He ordered champagne and smoked salmon from room service. They were both terrible smoked salmon addicts. "Could live on this," Tessa said, with a cat's purring smile, settling in to enjoy the adventure. Odd how she'd also started to delight in the planning, the setting up for the killing. There, in the Ritz, watching Ronnie doing the organization, she was stuck with the enormity of it all. She, Theresa Mary Murray, was as guilty as a murderer because she reveled in the act. They stayed in their suite while Ronnie worked the phones, calling contacts who knew him as Martin Meadows, international reporter, newspaper and TV station owner. Ronnie Richardson had been meticulous in building up connections in various parts of the media and elsewhere. Under several false names and occupations, he'd constructed lists of some complexity, for he had separate inventories for each alias in every European capital, plus New York, Miami, Chicago, and L.A. One of Richardson's obsessions was the constant refurbishment of his many pseudonyms and each of their circles of associates. This was the part he enjoyed most of all, the duplicity, the organization of his hidden lives. His contacts ran from the print media to police, doctors, and professional people of all kinds, even providers of macabre and unique services. He'd spent years building this strange and devious network, which was so intricate that he had to keep records of which character was known to which reporter, cop, or fixer in any given city. This data was constantly updated, hedged about with secret passwords and keystrokes on his powerful Macintosh G4 computer. The last thing he had done, as they prepared to leave the Villa Mirta, was transfer all this information from his desktop to a Palm 3 PDA, no larger than a packet of cigarettes, after which he erased the PowerPC's hard drive and used a program he'd written himself to scramble any traces on the drive. Even the most wired computer expert could not resurrect what had once been there, as it was constantly being overwritten again and again by the Book of Revelation, which filled the drive to overflowing. Within 5 minutes, the 10-gigabyte hard drive had been overwritten 7 times. Now, in the security of their suite at the Ritz, he pulled up on his Palm 3 the lists connected to Martin Meadows under London, and was, seconds later, speaking to the producer of a respected BBC current affairs program. "Hi, Barry. Martin Meadows here. I'm in London for a few days. You got a list of the boy Tunin's photo ops for this visit next week? I need to be clued in." "Yes, I know you can't let it out of your sight, Barry. I'd just like the salient times and places. Well, give them to me now. I have a pen hovering over a notepad as we speak. So be a good fellow." "Yes. Okay. Right." This was strictly against all rules of procedure at the Beeb, and Barry would have been horrified had he known to what use the information was being put. In the space of half an hour, Ronnie made 3 such calls and filched various parts of the schedule for the Russian president's visit to London. Later in the week, when they checked out of the Ritz and moved to a large hotel off Piccadilly Circus, Ronnie carried a complete itinerary for the president's visit. He knew where the presidential group would be and at what time for the entire 4 days due to begin on Monday. It was now even easier to get lost, because the staff at reception here in the Regent Palace were constantly changing, and nobody took any notice of who came and went in the huge beehive of a place. By this time, of course, the overstretched security service and the Metropolitan Police were on the lookout for someone, all right. 2 people, in fact. A man and a woman answering to the descriptions of Ronnie Richardson and Tessa Murray, who by now looked nothing like themselves. They even passed less than 4 feet from a pair of security service watchers, who were combing the larger hotels, taking quick shufties at guest lists in an attempt to spot any possibles. The woman of this pair actually looked up and into Ronnie's eyes, then looked away without a flicker of interest. This was not her fault. She was well-trained, but you couldn't expect miracles. The way Ronnie looked to her in that hotel foyer bore little relation to the way he was reported to look in the official description and artist's reconstruction. It is a large place, the Regent Palace, so large that it even has a special chute down which the body of any unfortunate guest who dies in a hotel can be quietly taken away, far from prying eyes. That evening, Ronnie explained to Tessa in outline exactly how he intended to take the lives of President and Madame Bortunin. If it was to be done properly, much had to be accomplished before Monday, when the Russian delegation flew into Heathrow. Talking about the fine details of his plan aroused Ronnie. Tessa had noticed this before and knew what to expect, for he always became sexually stimulated when discussing a meticulously detailed plot. So she took him in her hand, then her mouth, and then into her body, with her clothes draped around the room, following Ronnie and Tessa's inventive sexual ritual, which involved the furious ripping off of clothes, in particular the pretty filmy silk underclothes she had worn. Sometimes it seemed that Ronnie and Tessa took more pleasure in the preliminaries and the foreplay than the final plunging and lunging of their bodies.